All right, thank you. I'm Ryan. I'm from UC Santa Cruz, and I'm part of this 1M2H team. So I was asked to speak about the early optical spectra of this source, which we call SSS17A. I guess since it's only visible in the optical for about a week, this means like the first night. So this talk might be short. But I will say, you know, so here's my team in Santa Cruz, and I really want to show my team because they're the ones who did most of the work. I'll also point out that, you know, besides me and Enrico Ramirez-Ruiz, they're all grad students and postdocs. We have a very diverse group. More than half of our group is either female or an underrepresented minority. And again, they're just fantastic. We worked in collaboration with a lot of people from Carnegie. Maria and Tony are in the room. Josh and Ben are not here. And then also with Dan, who's in the room, and then Armin Rest from Space Telescope. You can find great things on the internet. So I was tasked to talk specifically about the early spectra, and really, you know, people might think that we are seeing a bunch of these different potential components for the ejecta, but I'll say, you know, before showing any spectra, that we're pretty confident that we're not actually seeing a GRB afterglow at early times, and instead really are seeing something that we would call a kilonova. And then the real question is exactly what the physical components there are and where did they come from. This was shown in Maria's talk. In fact, I bet a bunch of my slides were shown already in somebody else's talk. But the basic idea here is that in this neutron-rich environment, we would expect there to be a lot of R process elements created, these heavy elements, as we heard very well from Jennifer's talk earlier, have these high opacities. So if you get into the lanthanides, you get these really high opacities. And something that hasn't been shown yet, but, you know, should be kept in mind is the opacity of the line transitions. It's not necessarily dominant at every wavelength. Eventually, you get into electron scattering. And so for normal supernovae, for instance, or stars, right, even stellar atmospheres, iron is very important in the UV, where you have line blanketing. But in the optical, or at least the redder part of the optical in the near-infrared, electron scattering is important. With these lanthanides, however, it seems like the line opacities are essentially important always. Even for this green model here, it's very close to electron scattering at all times, so it's always sort of important. And this is really where everything within the SED, including the spectra, we're going to have to take into account where these lines are absorbing material and if we can distinguish between these different opacity sources. So we've talked before about the possibility of there being some material that is very R process heavy, and then maybe some other material that's R process light. And for the purposes of the opacities, what we really are talking about are if you have these lanthanides or not. And just the basic arguments here are that if you have higher opacity material, you're going to take longer for the light to get out, so you'll peak longer. And based on the opacities that we saw, the light will be easier to get out at redder wavelengths. If, however, you have lanthanide-free or lanthanide-light, maybe we can get an official naming convention for these things, then if it's more like iron, if you have a small amount of mass, it'll peak very early and fade very early, but it'll be blue because the light can get out more in the optical or even the UV. And the sources here, it really what determines the differences in these opacities are the composition, and that has to do with these electron fractions. And so if, again, you can distinguish between these different opacity sources, effectively you could say what the conditions were when that material was produced. So our team, the 1 meter, 2 hemispheres team, we operate two small telescopes to search for these gravitational wave sources. These are actually reversed in order. This is the SWOP telescope at Las Campanas Observatory in Chile, and this is the Nickel telescope, which is at Lick Observatory in California. And I'm going to tell you the story of how we found this event, both because you know, I think it's moderately entertaining, and if you haven't seen it yet, then it's worth spending some time. But it's critical for really getting to the very early spectra that we were able to find. So the story from my end starts when my graduate student, Dave Coulter, sent me a text message telling me to pay attention that there was this new gravitational wave source. I thought he was joking because I was trying to take the afternoon off, but eventually he convinced me that things were were real, and I went and found him and the rest of my group that were in Copenhagen at the time. I was in Copenhagen with Dave and my other graduate student Matt Siebert. In Santa Cruz, Charlie Kilpatrick, who's a postdoc, and Cesar Rojas Bravo, who's a grad student, were there to analyze some of our data. At the same time, Tony and Maria were in Pasadena trying to keep up with all the excitement, but at Las Campanas, on the two separate Magellans, Josh Simon and Ben Chappie were operating each one of those. And so Josh and Ben were part of the search. They were searching with the Magellans alongside our search with SWOP. You know, we went through this whole process of figuring out our observing strategy somewhat on the fly. And you can read this all. This is in published in our paper. From what I understand, this is the first time a chat log has ever been published in a scientific journal. Eventually, we get to the point where we start getting data, and we start seeing that there are galaxies there, but no transients, until eventually Charlie in Santa Cruz, who was reducing the data, found something, and you know, in his very understated way, this is what he said. I was slightly more excited. Surprisingly, in all the pages of this, there are no expletives. We didn't have to censor anything. So you know, this was the before shot, and then goes. Yep. Okay. Good. Then the after shot. Maybe I'll just go back. And immediately, the point here is that we found this very early on. And one of the first things we thought about was to get a spectrum, of course. This is just a reminder. This is our error region. The order in which we observe things are these fields that are numbered. In our ninth image, we got the image of SSS 17A. This is that image. There's our galaxy. When we zoom in, that's our source. So this was the discovery image. When Charlie saw this, we moved all these other pieces into gear. And why this was so important that we found it so early is that at the time, this is taken at the time of the discovery, this was the position of the error region relative to the horizon in Chile, and then the 30 degrees off of the horizon. So effectively for the LIGO people or the theorists, you don't really want to point your telescope more over than just about there. And of course, this was at the time of discovery. With time, the Earth is rotating, and so you can. All right. So just a step back, Astro 101, right ascension, right. So every hour in time, your right ascension overhead is moving by 1 hour, okay? So that's why we do that, if you didn't know. And so what that means is that, you know, we're roughly an hour at discovery, roughly an hour from this edge where we would no longer want to observe or be able to easily observe. And if we had found things a half an hour later or an hour later, it would be difficult to get additional information. So we immediately contacted Josh and Ben and said we had this candidate, and even though they were doing a search doing imaging, they wanted to switch over to getting spectra with both Magellans. They did that. This is observations at roughly 12 hours from both of these Magellans. Now, besides being the first spectra of this event, and we can step back and think about a little bit about what's going on here, having two spectra at roughly the same time that show roughly the same results, that's useful. Now, the first thing that you should notice about this is that it's essentially featureless. The second thing you should notice is that it's very blue, where the peak is really kind of like at where we're ending our observations. So right around 3,500 angstroms or maybe 4,000 angstroms is where these spectra peak. Now, we trust our data reduction enough to say that it seems like there is some turnover here. And we also trust our data reduction enough to say that if you just take a black body fit to both of these spectra, that the temperatures you get are slightly different, where the first one is about 11,000 Kelvin, and this is more like 9,500 Kelvin. Now, the times are different. So it doesn't seem like it's that much, right? It's only, you know, I don't know, less than an hour different in time, but the delta T over T is about 0.1, and the delta, you know, temperature over temperature is also about 0.1. So that might be something that's reasonable. And this discussion that Yair was having about what we do with the bolometric luminosity and how we treat the temperature at early times, I think these spectra in particular are going to play a crucial role in that. Now, of course, we already saw that things changed very dramatically early on. And again, since I was limited to just the optical, we only got about a week of data in the optical before it faded completely away. But the spectral evolution is very dramatic. So from, at 0.5 to a day later, you can see that not only has the continuum shape changed dramatically, you might even infer some features, and I think some people later on are going to talk about possible features in that spectrum. And then when you get on to the later days, there's definitely some sort of spectral feature. Now, we can debate if those are absorption features or if instead there's an emission feature. There was this discussion earlier of if there could be a black body here and then another black body here, and I don't think that that's possible. I think the spectral features are too narrow for it to be a separate black body peak. It could potentially have another peak and then there'd be a feature in the near infrared, though. Of course, we weren't the only ones to get spectra. There were a lot of groups, and again, I'm just focusing on the optical ones. A lot of people got near-infrared spectra, which have a lot of detailed information, especially about spectral features. So I'm just going to focus on the papers that specifically dealt with optical spectra. Apologies if I missed something. But this is work by Curtis McCulley, who's in the audience somewhere. There he is, showing a very good spectral sequence that obtained data from South Africa and then also from LCO and then eventually from Gemini South. And this South African spectrum is also particularly interesting. It's also shown in another paper that I'll show in a little bit because there's an interesting sequence. Work by Matt Nickel, he also has a very nice spectral sequence that shows this dramatic change in the spectral evolution. And importantly, there was this Hubble spectrum at 5.5 days after the trigger. And there's no signal there. But that at least is still informative. You might not, expect there to be something considering the spectral slope then. But I think one of the big questions is, at 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 7 days, at some point, if you do have this blue component, it will go optically thin. You might expect there to be nebular lines. And even though you might not expect there to be continuum in the UV, maybe there would be an emission line there. We don't see something there. We also don't see any obvious narrow nebular lines in the optical that you might expect from say supernovae that we see. Now, there are a few other interesting early time spectra. In particular, there's this spectrum from Australia at plus 1 day, and then this spectrum from South Africa a little bit later. And it's difficult to see exactly. You can definitely see that there's a very fast spectral evolution, again, on the timescale of delta T over T of about 0.1. you can see that there's spectral evolution. And I think there's been some questions. In particular, this Buckley paper attempts to take this second spectrum here and tries to fit some spectral features to the data here. I'm not confident in exactly if those are features or if they're data reduction artifacts, but it certainly would be very interesting if we really did see a spectral feature here. Now, one of the reasons why those spectral features are so interesting is that the lack of features almost certainly means that this material was moving at very high velocity. So essentially, this is work that Dan showed with you know, everybody else I think on that paper's in this room. Maybe no, Brian's not here. Where if you take a low velocity spectrum for this light R process or R process free, or this is really lanthanide free, right? So yeah, light R process spectrum, and you start to increase the velocity, not changing the composition, you just smooth out the features. And so really, when you're at like 0.3C, that's when you get something that's completely featureless. And this is also consistent with the velocities that you infer just from the luminosity and the temperature. So from these sort of explanations, you can say that this material is moving at relatively high velocity. Dan also does the same thing in the infrared for the heavy R process, but this is beyond my window. One of the interesting questions, though, is it seems like both this red and blue component, if they are physically distinct, seem to be moving at roughly the same velocity, you know, something like 0.15 to 0.3C. And this blue component fades away quickly. So a question I have is, if that blue component is fading away so quickly, is that because it's becoming optically thin? Is it because it's cooling? Or is it because of some geometric effect? And so I think that all these have different implications. If it's a geometric effect, it's still actually bright, but somehow now you're blocking it with this high opacity material. Then that'll have an influence on the overall luminosity of that high opacity material. If it becomes optically thin, then you might expect there to be these nebular emission lines. If the temperature just drops, then that's not as interesting, but eventually it would become nebular, and you would expect there to be some emission unless somehow it was blocked by some higher opacity material. So again, just you know, to note early on, we have this very fast change in the temperature here. For this material. So my personal guess is that things are changing in temperature very quickly, and the change in the luminosity is not just some geometric effect. And so when we start doing the two-dimensional models or three-dimensional models that Jennifer was talking about earlier, I think this is going to be, again, a key component to this. Ben Chappie took this a step further by comparing all of the spectra to these different components. And what he found is, you know, all right, if you only have a red component, then things don't work out very well. If you have a blue-only component, then you can match these early time spectra well, and of course it fails at later times. But he also said if you go and just simply assume that you have some sort of wind coming off of this disk early on, the velocities that you would infer from that are typically a bit lower, like, you know, 0.1 or C or lower, and you would see some spectral features that we just don't see in the model. So just based on that, you might disfavor the disk wind model unless somehow you can boost those velocities. Now, we did a slightly more detailed comparison in this paper by Charlie Kilpatrick, and you know, in addition to matching the overall light curves, we were able to you know, find this transition where the early time data look like they match pretty well, and the late time data match pretty well, but maybe in the intermediate stage it's not as good. So Dan's idea here of having two distinct components works in the one-dimensional case at least, but and you know, both photometry and spectroscopy. But the question really is, you know, if you do this in multi-D, can you really get the same observations? And I'm running out of time, and we've kind of gone over this in general. This object is particularly unique amongst all the different transits that you have. The spectrum is very different from other spectra we see early on. It also, of course, faded very rapidly compared to other transients. And you know, just so people see, this is delta M7, the change in magnitude from peak brightness to 1 week later in the G band. These are all of the supernovae that we could get, including some things that we used to call fast. And here's our object SSS17A, which faded more than 5 magnitudes in the G band over a week. So a week later, it had less than 1% the flux as what it had at peak. It also quickly changed color. This is also unprecedented. And the combination of these things means that we really haven't seen anything like it. If you look at all the nearby transients around, you can put a rate on this just from transient surveys, which is something like less than 0.2 per century. Stefano, somewhere in the audience, he also did this. Some other people did this as well and got similar numbers of something like 0.2, which is still an order of magnitude or so above the LIGO constraints where they made a detection. So in summary, you know, just for this early optical spectra, the blue featureless spectrum early on, probably telling you, you know, that you have this separate component that's low opacity, high velocity. This red spectrum later, and it's a little unclear exactly if those are physically distinct, and if they are, how the geometry plays a role. You probably either have this unobscured lanthanide-free ejecta that are either overrun or they somehow become optically thin. They became optically thin. Where are the nebular lines? And so with that, I think I'll stop and take questions. Thank you.
So this is a question for the theorist as much as for Ryan. So you said maybe at intermediate time, say that one day, that the models didn't predict enough blue flux. Do you or do any of the theorists have any ideas where that might be coming from?
Well, I'll wait to hear what the theorists say.
I mean, we kind of talked about this before. I mean, I think it's a combination of some sort of shock cooling and radioactivity, and it's whatever the proportion is. And the issues are things like, do you think the radioactively powered component can get up to 0.3C naturally with enough mass, or do you need, for example, some sort of cocoon to accelerate it, like in Monsi and Udi's paper? Those are the main ideas people have, I would say.
Yeah, so I
guess there's something else would be neutrons is something people discuss, but nobody's really claimed that for this event.
Yeah, I think, you know, you could generically, you know, not being a theorist, you can generically say that there's an additional component early on and then start to rule things out. Like, it still doesn't seem like this is a GRB afterglow or something like that. It does seem relatively thermal. I think, you know, Tony at least had some good ideas for what it could be.
To clarify that, is there a mismatch? I thought you showed model spectra at 0.5 days, 1 day, so it looked not too bad.
Yeah, you made some nice models. So I don't know if there's a mismatch. I think generically what you can say is that you can fit models that match the spectra early on, and you can fit models that match the spectra later. And then the question is just how do you do this transition correctly? You know, at plus 1 week, how do you make those two work? And I think you would say something along the lines of, I'm producing this in this model some optically thick emission. There's a continuum here, some sort of photosphere still, and that might not be the case, right? It might be optically thin by that time. Maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this is a simple model where you take one blue model, add it to one red model, but there's probably some interesting gradient and abundances. And as you start to tweak that, you start to get the right evolution at the right rate. So that'll take some time.
And I'll just add, I mean, maybe if you have enough mass, you can get to those models if that's a free parameter. But then the question is, do you expect enough dynamically kind of ejected material moving fast enough to be able to produce that luminosity at day 0.5 or not with real simulation?
So I had a question maybe just for, again, people who have done dynamical modeling, but a lot of times you've mentioned nebular, low velocity nebular lines, but a nebular line is a low velocity only if there's enough mass at the Hubble flow at zero velocity or if it's running into anything. So when one actually looks at dynamical mass ejection with the fallback, is there enough material near zero velocity at these times you actually would get narrow ejecta, or is the disk wind pushing it? So in fact, it's a shell all at high velocity. It seems might be interesting questions.
Yeah, I think those are incredibly interesting. And then you almost certainly, even if it's optically thin, there's still some optically thick component beneath it. So you're not seeing the traditional, you know, full line. You'd only see the bluer component anyway. I think this is something for some of the both the modelers on the dynamics, but then also the radiative transport people to really get into. And right. So if you have a shell, then it could be narrow, but you could also have 1,000 lines that make everything look broad. And I don't know what to expect at all.
Okay. Any more questions?
It's more a question for. Of course, for Ryan, but also for other people in the audience, since I don't know any UV spectra in the nebular phase, so I have no idea which line we should see. Does anyone has any idea what you should see in a nebular spectra in the UV? For
I don't think we know in the optical or the near infrared, right? What I can say is for some supernovae, you can think about what you might see there. For iron, there's really not that much. But for lower mass elements, you might expect things like magnesium and stuff like that, but certainly carbon and oxygen. For these, I have no idea if you would expect anything in the UV.
It would be hard, given that to get a UV line, you need to have temperatures to excite a pretty high excitation line. And so the temperatures are getting colder. It's harder to go up to, several EV, but unless there's some non-thermal effects that can get you there. So. Yeah, so you might have radioactive decay, sort of ionizing things and then them cascading down through UV lines, maybe.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, so let's thank all our speakers this morning and break for lunch. We resume at, I believe it's 2:00.
Are we doing lunch here?
Lunch is in the courtyard. And don't forget to wear your name tag so they know you're from our program and not the others.